In confidence. Recently, I wrote about the continuum of hope, fantasy, and delusion within the context of playing the lottery. I realize now that I forgot to consider confidence, that extra added ingredient that can reset the continuum to the right or left. For example, supreme confidence can turn fantasy into hope, and delusion into fantasy. Confidence is born somewhere in the depths of that seething black box we call the brain, and it is a gift that we can bestow upon ourselves, other individuals, or institutions. Self-confidence, like hope, is a key factor in helping us all get out of bed in the morning, and from day one, the role of parents is to foster self-confidence in their children. One strategy is to identify that thing that the kid will be good at, and parents with wherewithal can madly throw opportunities at their child, hoping that one will stick and become a core part of the child's identity. Soccer is a frequent starting point to determine whether sports is an option. There are miniature violin lessons, art lessons, taekwondo lessons, chess lessons, dance class. It is a mad dash to find something to build confidence around. But confidence is such a slippery thing. After careful nurturing, it can totally implode with the slightest provocation. You only have to watch individual sports, like singles tennis or golf, to witness the vanishing act. I was just watching a singles ladies tennis match between Li Na and Maria Sharapova. Li Na had won the first set and was up 4-love in the second, and suddenly, without warning, her confidence evaporated and she lost the next 7 games. Maria was cruising 3-0 in the final set, and then Li Na sucked it up and got back into the game. Maria finally prevailed in a third set tiebreaker. One hallmark of coaching prowess is consistency over time, and consistency is based on confidence. It must drive coaches batty trying to unravel the enduring mystery of the mental game. Confidence in another person is just as ephemeral. One or two little incidents can queer a relationship. A missed block in football, an empty promise, or a moment of self-serving dissembling can have lasting effects. The normally tight spiral flutters as the quarterback imagines an oncoming 350-pound behemoth. There's a hair trigger on a plan B, and routine explanations are now fact-checked. And then there is confidence in the workplace, especially in your boss. I have learned that this is a rare thing that must be cherished. A boss who has confidence in his team, provides them with opportunities to do what they do best, and then shares any credit for success. I got lucky in one of my first jobs, but have found it tough going ever since then. And after being thrown under the bus a couple of times, I ultimately decided that self-employment was the best option. Confidence in an institution is the bedrock of democracy. And like other examples, it is hard to win and easy to lose. Let's look at our military. I still remember the failed 1980 air raid to recapture the American hostages held in Iran, called Operation Eagle Claw. Helicopters flailed around in a sandstorm in the staging area. One ran into another and blew up, and the mission was aborted before even getting to Tehran. Somehow I wasn't surprised and thought, wow, I guess there is some truth to the military expressions, snafu, situation normal all fucked up, FUBAR, fucked up beyond all recognition, and SUSFU, situation unchanged, still fucked up. But while I lack confidence in the military as an institution, I do have utmost confidence in individual soldiers. For our anniversary, I got my husband an autobiography called American Sniper, primarily because I'm convinced that Nick would make an excellent sniper due to his birdwatching skills in detecting the slightest movement at great distances. Chris Kyle is celebrated as the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history, tallying 150 official kills, smashing the previous record of 109. He cheerfully describes kill after kill and proudly notes that he is so accurate in nailing the target T-zone, i.e. the head and neck, that the insurgents die before they hit the ground and feel no pain. He may be a killing machine, but I have minimal confidence that the stifling military bureaucracy has put him on the correct rooftop or behind the correct bush. Similarly, I have total confidence that U.S. SEAL Team 6 can successfully storm a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, but more limited confidence that the CIA identified the right house. After all, the whole weapons of mass destruction thing in Iraq was a total tarfu, totally and royally fucked up. So it was a great relief to learn that we dodged a Bohica, bend over, here it comes again, a Bohica moment when Osama bin Laden was indeed inside and swiftly disposed of. On the domestic front, it turns out that our government is very interested in our own confidence, specifically our confidence as consumers, since an economy can only be healthy if it's growing and we are spending money. Economists are great at crunching numbers and making projections, but they cannot capture the spending habits of our elusive animal spirits, a term coined by the economist John Maynard Keynes. The methods for assessing consumer confidence don't strike me as particularly scientific. Pollsters just call some 5,000 households on a monthly basis and ask random people four or five questions. All the responses are collected and massaged a bit, and out spits a number that is then compared to a number from the previous month. While consumer confidence may help set the government's economic policy, a positive number can go viral. A news report of improving confidence might just boost mine, motivating me to buy an extra pint of raspberries at the farmer's market and not care if they go moldy. And then I may bump into a neighbor at the market who finally bought a hybrid she wanted when she landed a better job, and her confidence might encourage me to buy a scooter so that I can go to the farmer's market and buy raspberries and a baguette and feel very French. And just maybe, if my animal spirits are particularly restless, I might go to France itself. The trickle-down effect of confidence. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there is the issue of our rusty old mailbox. In a childish display of petulance, we refuse to replace it, primarily to annoy our very fussy and demanding neighbors, whose gleaming wrought iron mailbox contrasts with our raggedy and rickety one. Visually, we may be bringing our neighborhood down. But I wonder if the neighbors think that budget constraints are the reason we have not upgraded our mailbox. Is our childish behavior subtly undermining our neighborhood's consumer confidence? I think that the surveys are really asking whether or not we have confidence in the government to manage the economy. Can a bureaucracy apply a deft touch to hit that sweet spot between irrational exuberance and recession, and do it in an equitable way, such that protesters don't descend on Wall Street snarling at sleek bankers slinking around in chauffeured cars? But these questions would be just too pointed. So instead, the surveys ask about such things as job prospects, or whether or not you're thinking about upgrading your appliances. I would love to be one of these random participants, to be part of the pulse of the American economy. But I would also be the pollster's worst nightmare. The polls limit your question to three categories, i.e. better, worse, the same, that eliminate any kind of thoughtful or nuanced response. ABC News and Money Magazine publishes the Consumer Comfort Index. One of the questions they would ask me is, considering the cost of things today and your own personal finances, would you say now is an excellent time, a good time, or not so good a time, or a poor time to buy the things you want and need? Now, presumably, the pollsters have slaved over this survey, choosing each word very carefully so that everyone is essentially answering the same question. But the first question that I would ask the interviewer is to explain the difference between what I want and what I need. From my point of view, this is the most fundamental question that must be addressed by anyone who contributes to the big splat of the affluent American carbon footprint. Wants and needs lie on a continuum with an individual and shifting dividing line between the two, a line that might, in fact, reflect consumer confidence. What I think I need may be an extravagant want to someone who is struggling to get by. And if I am trying to be a responsible steward of this dear planet, I should reset my line and convert some of my needs to more optional wants. For example, I just don't need out-of-season raspberries flown here from Chile, and I can be equally French by riding my bike to the farmer's market with a baguette sticking out the pannier. But by now, the interviewer would have hung up in exasperation. The government just doesn't really care how I self-identify needs and wants, and it is just hoping that I'm going to be a patriotic American and spend some money.